From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. After 13 years of war, the U.S. will leave Afghanistan next year. You're going to hear a lot about the war between now and then. Did we win? Was it worth the cost? What's become of the war on terror? But before all that starts, let's take a step back from the politics and the war and look at something we in the West rarely talk about. Afghan fiction. And if you want to talk about Afghan fiction, there is one place you simply must start. Khaled Hosseini. His novel, The Kite Runner, put Afghan fiction on the map. Here's Anne Strangechamps with Hosseini on his new book, And the Mountains Echoed.
This book opens with a story, a folktale, which not only sets the stage for the rest of the book, but kind of echoes through it in different ways. I was wondering, could you begin by telling us that story?
Sure. The fable is actually being told by a father to his two children the night before they're going to set off from this village and go to Kabul. But the fable is about a village that is visited by a creature called a div, which is this mythical creature that has been prevalent in Persian literature and mythology for a long, long time. The div comes to this village and picks a household and demands that that household grant him one child that he will then take away and the family will never see the child again. If the family refuses, then the div will take all the children from the household. So he picks the household of this old peasant who's got five kids. They draw straws and he has to give away his favorite child to this creature.
It's heartbreaking to read and also really beautiful. What was in your mind when you wrote it?
Well, I use the fable as a kind of a peek into the mind of a man, a father, the father who's telling this story to his children and is about to make a rather agonizing decision of his own. And it's his way of explaining, I think, his actions to his kids, particularly his boy.
Yeah. Well, at the heart of this story are these two children, Abdullah and this little boy and his sister Parry. And we meet them that night when their father is telling them that fable. And the next day, they are separated for close to the rest of their lives. What happens?
Well, we meet them, you know, as they're crossing a desert with their father. And they're walking to Kabul, where their father has ostensibly found work for construction work, where he's going to build something for this wealthy couple. What happens there is, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but is it basically ruptures the bond between the boy and his sister. And that's the heart of the book, is this very loving relationship between Abdullah, who's 10 years old, and his little sister, Parry. And they're extremely close. He's almost like both father and mother to his little sister. They've lost their mother in childbirth when Parry was born, and they're not particularly close to their stepmother. And so the loss of his little sister is very wounding to Abdullah and in many ways shapes the adult that he eventually becomes. We'll meet later in the book. And it also affects Parry in more subtle but no less profound ways and also shapes the person that she becomes. And sort of the respective absences of these two people from each other's lives becomes a kind of looms over the rest of the novel.
Yeah. The little girl, Parry, who winds up moving away to Paris. She's so young when she's taken from Afghanistan. She really barely remembers. But you write, there's some really beautiful passages where you write about that she has this kind of sense that something's missing. I wrote this down. What did she? Oh, yeah. She felt this absence. You wrote, it was vague, like a message sent across shadowy byways and vast distances, a weak signal on a radio dial, remote, warbled. Other times it felt so clear, this absence, so intimately close, it made her heart lurch. Sounds like you know that feeling.
I don't know that that's personal experience, but what I loved about Parry, who's the little girl who's separated from her brother and ends up moving to Europe, and and doesn't really even really remember her brother, doesn't even really remember her former life because it all happened when she was so young. And yet there's this sense that there's a hole in her life, that there is the narrative of her life is incomplete. She just has a sense that there's a blind spots that her adoptive mother has not filled in for her. And, you know, she says in that chapter that a parent's job is to kind of take these scraps of memories that are otherwise disjointed and glue them together and provide the glue so that you can fashion a cohesive and understandable narrative of your own life. And she feels like that's missing from her life. But I really kind of liked writing about this kind of vague but very much and this very powerful kind of aching that was always in her life.
It's funny that both the loss of her memory she feels as a kind of wound, and yet there are plenty of other characters in the book for whom memories are very painful.
Yes. This theme of memory opens the book and ends the book. And I kind of really enjoyed exploring this idea of memory either as this thing that allows us to make sense of our life, as something, a faculty through which we make sense of who we are, of our world, that gives us our identity, something that protects those parts of our life that we cherish the most and experiences them that are so meaningful to us, or as this kind of dictator that forces upon you things you would rather forget, experiences that are wounding and painful to live through, and yet we have to because we don't have a choice. And so this, you know, dual nature of memory begins the book. In the fable that I spoke about earlier, the father is given a potion by this creature through which he can forget about his son and he can forget about the loss of his son, and that sort of pain is magically removed from his life.
Well, and that question of, is the potion a gift or a curse?
Right.
I mean, what about for you personally? Do you feel like your memories of Afghanistan are more blessing or curse?
To me, they're a blessing because they're very happy memories for the most part. I was fortunate enough to live through the final years of an era that is an almost forgotten, bygone era now. To the average person, you say the word Afghanistan, and the set of images that it conjures is so different from my childhood memories, in which Afghanistan was, you know, let's not overplay it. You know, it was a deeply impoverished country then, and people lived in abject poverty even then. But nevertheless, you know, this were the days before extremism and before the Taliban, before the criminal networks and the terrorists and, all the foreign troops and so on. It was, comparatively speaking, a far more innocent era, certainly peaceful, and from my perspective, a very happy era. And so I cherish those memories. I wouldn't trade them for anything. They're memories that I've dipped into in my novels over and over again.
Well, I was thinking, I know President Karzai some years ago, actually it's back around 2002, I think, made a famous speech in which he called on the people who had left Afghanistan to return. And I was thinking, maybe what Afghanistan needs is not necessarily for all of its people to return, but for those who remember what Afghanistan was like when it was still whole, to keep those memories alive.
Yes, I think that does serve a purpose, but we have more or less passed the baton on now to the youth of Afghanistan. And I think the memories that will end up serving Afghanistan well is those of the youthful population of Afghanistan. It's a fundamentally young country. 60% is under the age of 20. And they've come of age during the war, and they will use those memories to shape a different future for Afghanistan. This is now a population that is becoming increasingly savvy. You know, the young, urban, professional Afghans, they're increasingly sophisticated in their thinking through their involvement with technology, through the internet, through the sort of interconnectedness of the modern world. It can't be stopped. Eventually, new experiences, new ways of thinking will infiltrate Afghanistan. And I think that is the way of the future. The immediate future may be cloudy, may be worrisome, and may be painful to watch. But I think ultimately Afghanistan will change from within because of its young population that does have these painful memories, and I think they're motivated to do something about them.
Khaled, is there a section from your book you might end by reading for us?
I'd love to. The section I'm about to read is we meet Pari, who is a little girl who was torn from her brother. She's now, I guess, in her 60s, and she's living in France, and she has received a phone call through which she learns about the fact that she had a brother. Pari's hands shake. A startling thing is happening to her, something truly remarkable. The picture of it in her mind is of an axe striking soil and suddenly rich black oil bubbling up to the surface. This is what's happening to her. Memory struck upon, rising up from the depths. She gazes out the window in the direction of the brasserie, but what she sees is not the skinny waiter beneath the awning, black apron tied at the waist and shaking a cloth over a table, but a little red wagon with a squeaky wheel bouncing along beneath a sky of unfurling clouds, rolling over ridges and down dried-up gullies, up and down ochre hills that loom and then fall away. She sees washing lines and women squatting by a stream, and a hawk-nosed man digging a ditch, shirt plastered to his back with sweat, and a veiled woman bent over a cooking fire. But something else, too, at the edge of it all, at the rim of her vision, and this is what draws her most, an elusive shadow, a figure, at once soft and hard, the softness of a hand holding hers, the hardness of knees where she'd once rested her cheek. She searches for his face, but it evades her, slips from her each time she turns to it. Pari feels a hole opening up in her. There has been in her life, all her life, a great absence. Somehow she has always known. Brother, she says, unaware she's speaking, unaware she's weeping.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure entirely.
That was Khaled Hosseini discussing his novel And the Mountains Echoed with Anstrain Champs. His novels The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns have sold more than 38 million copies. He's currently the goodwill envoy to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about Afghan stories, novels, films, folktales, poetry. But as Steve Paulson found out, there is another Afghan story, carpets. Steve, really? Carpets?
Yeah. Carpets, that's right, Jim. Well, carpets are one of the oldest and most cherished works of art made in Afghanistan. And the tradition of carpet weaving goes back thousands of years there. And Afghan carpets are famous. They're considered the most beautiful rugs in the world. And the best ones sell in New York for tens of thousands of dollars. But the real story is how they're made.
And you talked with a journalist who stayed in one of these, carpet villages?
Yeah, Anna Bodkin. She first went to Afghanistan right after 9/11. She was a war reporter, and she kept going in. She went there a number of times, and she kept going to cover the latest political or military developments. But she got tired of that. She felt like she wasn't seeing the real Afghanistan. She wanted to slow down, so she went to a really remote village called Oka. Population, 240. They're mostly Turkomans who live there. She spent close to a year there getting to know the people, especially the carpet weavers. And Anna Bodkin has now written a book called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. And she started our conversation by reading a passage from her book.
Any rug merchant in the Khorasan will tell you two factors determine the beauty of a carpet. One is the density of its knots. An experienced carpet dealer will count the knots by ear running his fingernail across the hard ridges on the reverse side of the rug. The higher the pitch of the scraping sound, the finer the yarn, the closer together the knots, the longer the carpet will retain the luscious bounce of its pile. The dealer also might fold the carpet and press on the fold. The wool of a tightly woven carpet will spring back after the rug is unfolded, leaving no sign of a crease. Designs are plenty, but which design a customer finds attractive is only a matter of taste, of subjective preference. True beauty, on the other hand, is indisputable.
That is wonderful. Thank you. Now, one thing that I found fascinating in your description of the making of these carpets is perfection is not actually that highly valued. In fact, one of the signs that these are handmade is that there are flaws in the carpets.
Well, first of all, in the Muslim tradition, perfection, man-made perfection, offends the omnipotence of God. So perfection is not allowed in a carpet. And sometimes a weaver will, on purpose, weave a mistake into her carpet. But that usually is not necessary because a carpet takes on the shape and the life of a weaver because it's woven over a long period of time, between 4 and 9 months. And so there will be a moment when the weaver is distracted because a goat had stumbled into or onto her loom and she has to stand up and chew the goat away. Or, for example, a neighbor came in and started gossiping and the weaver started laughing and forgot the count of thread and had accidentally woven an extra petal into a stylized almond tree and so on and so forth. So each carpet is unique and becomes the diary of the carpet weaver.
Hmm. Well, the woman who you focus on, the particular weaver, is named Thaura. What was she like?
Very taciturn young woman in her early 30s, probably, because most Afghans who are illiterate, and most Afghans are illiterate, very rarely know how old they are. Who wants to count the seasons of privation? Very quiet most of the time, but very open to sex gossip and giggles a lot when somebody comes in and tells her dirty jokes. She is a mother now of 3 children. She is one of the few women in Oka who does not take opium as a palliative because her father-in-law forbids it.
Hmm. So opium is widespread in this village?
Opium is omnipresent in this village because there is no other way to keep aches and pains at bay. There are no doctors nearby. There are no clinics. There are no pharmacies. So the only thing that you can use when you have a backache, and you almost always have a backache if you live in Oka, or a stomachache, you take a little bit of opium. If your child is crying because he's hungry or he's teething, you give him or her a little bit of opium. If you're pregnant and you have a backache and you feel nauseous, you take a little bit of opium. So you're exposing your child to opium prenatally. So basically, it's a village of addicts.
Wow. And also a village that makes extraordinary carpets.
It's a village of people who tell amazing stories. It's a village of people who are extraordinary hosts. It's a village of people who are probably sinners, and some are magnanimous and some are greedy and some probably are thieves and others are something. It's a village that is a sliver of humanity. It's a village of people just like us, just in different circumstances.
How did Thaura learn to make carpets?
She doesn't remember. Her daughter, Leila, who was 5 or 4 years old when I was in the village, was already helping her weave. So probably Thaura was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. And her mother probably was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. This is how the craft is passed down.
This is a very poor village, and I think it was at one point in your book you say that the families who make these carpets earn something like 40 cents a day. And it might cost $60 to buy the yarn for one rug, the rug that they're going to make the whole year. And then the scale of all of this starts to go up as these carpets are sold. They might go to a local dealer, but sold for he'll sell them for, what, $200? And then by the time they get to the United States, they sell for thousands of dollars, right?
Carpets for that are exported out of Afghanistan can travel either west to Istanbul or east to Islamabad or Peshawar in Pakistan, or they can fly out of Kabul south to Dubai. And that is where they gain hundreds of percent of their value. And then, of course, when they get from there to, say, Frankfurt or New York or San Francisco or Madison, Wisconsin, they become extraordinarily expensive.
How much are they sold for?
Here in the States, between $5,000 and $20,000 per carpet.
Wow. Which kind of makes you wish that the women who actually make them made more money.
A lot of things make me wish that women who make carpets made more money, not just the price, the exuberant, extortionist price of carpets that people pay for them here, but also the fact that, oh, I wish for these women healthy children who don't die of common cold that goes untreated and then becomes something worse. I wish for these women stomachs that are not so empty. I wish for these women ibuprofen when they have a headache, you know, a warm pair of socks in the winter.
Did you ever feel like you were in a bit of an ethical quandary there? I mean, because I'm guessing that that you could have helped solve some of the financial problems of the family that you were spending all this time with. I mean, you probably could have arranged to have them, you know, sell one of their carpets to a North American dealer for a lot of money. Did you ever consider this?
Okay, so let's say I agreed to help this one family in a village of 240 people, all of whom know me. How do I explain not helping everybody else? How do I then leave and never come back or don't come back for a few years? And what happens to this family? How are they viewed in their community? You know, when I go to Steve, feeling inadequate is sort of how you normally feel when you work in extremists. I feel extremely inadequate to the pain of the people, to the pain that I witness. And, you know, I console myself by bringing little treats, you know, a couple hundred kilos of rice, some onions. I console myself by saying that by telling stories that I witness, I am contributing somehow to the larger base of knowledge of the people who actually can help, can come and build something, can bring a team of a mobile team of healthcare workers to the village once every 3 months, for example, do things like that. And that's sort of where my job can find an outlet and can find a solution. But it's extremely hard, and it's hard to watch devastation and know that any kind of help you can offer is a Band-Aid.
Yeah. Did you feel like your job was essentially bearing witness? I mean, you were the person giving testimony of how these people are living.
You were saved not in order to live. You have little time. You must give testimony. That's a poem from a poem by Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet. That's sort of my lodestar. I guess that's also how I comfort myself when I feel very upset with how little I can do. I you know, I'm a storyteller, and I think that the idealist in me believes that somehow my storytelling can make the world a little closer.
Yeah. Could we end with another reading from your book?
I'm going to read from a passage from the end of the book. And what is happening here is my host, who has known me for almost 2 years, refuses to let me stay at his house. At length, Baba Nazar said, "Anna, I know in the past I have invited you to stay, but I don't think you should spend the night here." A deep breath, and suddenly I pictured us the way a bird would see us, a white dove cast off course, or a demoiselle crane perhaps halfway on its hallowed and again desecrated migration across the big slate sky. Two people working, a woman carrying food, an importunate visitor, and an old man barefoot in his black galoshes, his glasses held on his head by string, his Soviet shotgun a poor match for the war around him. Five tiny and fragile figures in the sodden desert, a poor man's carpet decocted out of an eternity of violence and generosity and grace. Each of us flawed and so complete. All of us woven into a time warp named Oka.
Anna Botkin's book about Oka is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Steve Paulson spoke with her. In Afghan culture, poetry is revered. In Kabul, in fact, you can find lines of famous poems graffitied on the sides of buildings. There are, though, some poems that are secret, like this one. "I call your stone. One day, you'll look and find I'm gone." There's a story behind that poem. Anne Strainchamps is here in the studio with me. You have the story.
Well, Jim, the story begins with a teenage girl named Rahila Muska, and she lived in Helmand, which, as we know, is one of the Taliban strongholds, has seen a lot of unrest. And like a lot of rural Afghan girls, she wasn't allowed to leave her home or go to school. Her father pulled her out of school after the fifth grade. And she found refuge in poetry. And the poem you just read is a Landai. That's a folk poem, part of a Pashtun tradition of women's poetry. And Rahila began to write and quote poems like this. And then one day, her brothers discovered that she was writing love poetry. And that's something that's considered very dishonorable. And they beat her badly. And in protest, Rahila doused herself with cooking oil and she set herself on fire. And she died.
Oh, my Lord. In our culture, it's hard to imagine a culture where a woman dies for writing poetry.
Yeah. And the reason we know about Rahila, her real name turned out to be Zarmina, is thanks to an American journalist and poet, Eliza Griswold. Eliza heard about Rahila, and she traveled to Afghanistan to try to find out more. And she uncovered this hidden poetry tradition, poems called Landais.
Landai means a short, poisonous snake. And this form, the Landai, is spoken by women for women. It's transmitted ear to ear, voice to voice, and has been over millennia. And it's very subversive. The things that women speak about, the issues of sex, war, longing, grief, separation, are issues that they're really not allowed to talk about in day-to-day life. And so the Landai, because it's collective, because it's anonymous, and because it's oral, allows women to share their innermost sentiments and disown them at the same time. For example, Rahila Muska, the young woman who was killed, could utter that Landai because she could say, "Well, that's not my poem." And although after her death, her father destroyed the notebooks that survived her, he was unable to kill or to wipe out a poem that was an oral tradition and had been passed among women for centuries.
I can't think of any other poetic form anywhere that is almost exclusive to women.
I think that's exactly right. And one reason women have particular purchase over the form of the Landai is because, of course, the women who are speaking these poems are largely illiterate. They can't read and write. And the Landai becomes, as it did for Ruhila Muska, an ongoing form of education and a way of speaking when there was no other form allowed to her.
They're so compact. I mean, these are like haikus in a way, but they're kind of dense with emotion. And I wanted to ask you about some that seem to be love poems to American soldiers, or actually they're sort of more like love-hate poems. So there's one, for instance, "My lover is fair as an American soldier can be. To him I looked dark as a Talib, so he martyred me." Wow.
Yeah. Now that's an old one, and it used to say, "My love is fair as a British soldier can be," because it is a tacit criticism of occupation. And of course, long before the Americans set foot in Afghanistan, there was the 19th century British occupation.
So there's a sense in which the soldiers are simply interchangeable. It's one more occupation for this area.
Oh, absolutely. The soldiers are interchangeable. Occupation is interchangeable. The enemy is interchangeable. And yet the idea of being misread, misunderstood, seen in a mistaken form, that the outsider is so blind to Afghan life that he will not understand or recognize his own lover. That's what stands at the heart of that poem.
There are also some really chilling anti-American poems. There's one, kind of couldn't get it out of my head. Wait, let me find it. This one's written by a mother. "My Nabi was shot down by a drone. May God destroy your sons, America. You murdered my own."
Yes. So the name of this mother was Chandana, and she did not sing this poem to me directly. This was repeated to me by her cousin. So she never would have written this poem because she cannot write. So this is just an oral tradition, and she would sing this. She did sing this at a wedding. And men and women are segregated for weddings, as they would be for any ceremony in Afghan society. And so in a women's wedding, typically at henna night before she's married, when the bride is decorated with henna on her hands and feet, women sing Landais. They sing them with a small hand drum called a daira. And yes, this mother, to her understanding, he was killed by a drone. Now, does she know that for sure? No way. But the drones are very prevalent in Afghan society now. In both the common consciousness and the rage against ongoing occupation, but also in the Landais, which was shocking to me that they'd entered the language of the Landais themselves.
Well, so some of these seem to be supportive of the Talibs. But then others aren't. There's one, "May God destroy the Taliban and end their wars. They've made Afghan women widows and whores."
Mm-hmm. There's rage. There's rage against all forms of oppression in these poems. And the Taliban, you know, they're not popular. People join. Here's what happens in a village. And this is why women sing about the Taliban with such disgust. In a village, the Taliban will come through and demand that a family give over one of their sons. And so that leads to rage, because in the same way that Chandana would sing about her rage at the Americans for killing her son Nabi, she would sing about her rage at the Taliban for taking one of her sons for their ranks as well. So, and moreover, because women have suffered so much under the rule of the Taliban regime, which still rules and has parallel governments in much of rural Afghanistan today, the hypocrisy of the religiosity of the Taliban, and yet the way in which when they were in power, they, you know, abused women, that really is a common theme of both women's talking to one another, but of course of the Landais as well.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting to me is the women's voices as they come out of these are so powerful. I mean, they just kind of jump off the page at you. I mean, these are not the voices of shy or modest or humble women. Did that surprise you?
It did and it didn't. I mean, because I've been working in Afghanistan for more than a decade on and off, I had some sense of the volubility, the rage, the earthiness that with which many Afghan women speak all the time. And as sort of, you know, I wear a couple of hats as a journalist and a poet. And so I love sort of looking at the edges of society. For both me and for the photographer Seamus Murphy, with whom I was working, who's worked in Afghanistan for 25 years, one of the things we wanted to do is sort of explode the image that we have in the West of an Afghan woman being, you know, a mute ghost beneath a blue burqa, because she is anything but. And the frankness with which women speak is woefully underreported because there's not much space for it in the news headlines. So what we were trying to do is get beyond those headlines and let these women speak for themselves.
And yet, at the same time, they may have strong voices, but so many of these poems are about their oppression. I mean, the really heartbreaking ones to me often are young girls who clearly are being married against their will. Oh, what's the one? There's something about, I dropped the spinach on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
How does that one go?
That one goes, today I dropped the spinach on the floor. Now the old goat stands in the corner swinging a 2x4.
Is there a Landai you would leave us with?
Sure. When sisters sit together, they are always praising their brothers. When brothers sit together, they are selling their sisters to others.
Eliza Griswold, speaking with Anne Strangechamps. Griswold went to the Pashtun region of Afghanistan to gather these poems for Poetry Magazine. This month's entire edition is dedicated to the Landai. To read more of them, go to our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
At the moment, I'm selling rugs. I'm sorry, my English is not so good. When I'm talking rugs, Australian people think I'm talking about drugs. Do you know R-U-G?
They mistake your pronunciation of rugs for drugs.
And I try to say R-U-G-S. I'm talking about rugs.
Rugs, I see. Thank you. That's our friend, the Hazara rug maker, Najaf Mazari. He had to run for his life from Afghanistan. He ended up in Australia, the war, the Taliban. It took a lot from Najaf, but it did not take his stories. The Hazara people have been telling folktales for thousands of years. Najaf Mazari and Robert Hillman have collected some of them in a book they call The Honey Thief. One of my favorites from this collection, a Hazara folktale called The Music School, ends with this pretty potent maxim. God is patient with the obedient, but he treasures the disobedient. You don't hear the Brothers Grimm ever saying that. Here's Robert Hillman retelling part of it.
Karimzand picked up the tula and put it to his lips. Within seconds, the dark little house with its unplastered walls was transformed into the garden of an emperor filled with the song of nightingales. Karimzand placed the tula on the cushion once more and said to Abdullah, "Pick it up." When Abdullah reached for the instrument with gladness, Karimzand said, "Wait." Then he pointed at the top of the tula and said, "Do not pick it up at this end, by any means, unless you wish to offend me." Then he pointed at the bottom of the tula from where the music emerged. "Do not pick it up from this end by any means, or you will certainly offend me." Finally, he pointed to the middle of the tula and said, "Do not pick it up here by any means, or you will offend me. I will use the instrument to bruise your skull." Abdullah was baffled. How could he grasp the tula if not at either end or not in the middle? He reached out his hand once, twice, 10 times, 20 times, and each time he withdrew it. Finally, he climbed to his feet, brushed the tears from his eyes, and went home. All through the next day, while he crushed beetles in his uncle's orchard, he thought about the tula and how it could be taken up in such a way that the madman would not be offended. He could find no solution. He thought to himself, "The master does not wish to teach me." All the same, his mind kept returning to the problem, but without reward. In the end, he went to the house of the madman, driven by the desire to learn the tula. He thought, "I'm becoming mad myself. Will this satisfy the master when I'm also a madman?" Karamzan sat the boy before the tula. "Now, pick up the instrument. However, I am a man quickly moved to anger. If you pick it up at this end, I will beat you to within an inch of your life. If you pick it up at this end, I will tear the skin from your bones and feed you to the ants. And if you pick it up here between the two ends, I will make myself a breakfast of your entrails." This time, Abdullah didn't consider anything except his desire to hold the tula. He reached out and grasped the instrument and held it firmly. He expected a blow from the madman, or even worse, the flash of a sharp knife. Instead, he saw on the face of Karamzan a smile that stretched from his left ear to his right. "You see," said Karamzan, "it is not so difficult to pick up the tula."
Robert Hillman, reading from Najaf Mazari's Hazara folktale called The Music School. Their book of Hazara folktales is called The Honey Thief. That's a homeless Afghan kid, one of the boys in the film Buzgashi Boys. TT Book producer Charles Monroe Kane says that Buzgashi Boys was one of his favorite films of 2012. Charles, what was it that you liked about it?
Well, Jim, the film was one of the shorts nominated for an Oscar this year, and for me it really stood out. First, because it was filmed in Afghanistan entirely by a U.S. and Afghan crew.
Which is pretty amazing. I mean, it's a country we're at war with, right?
I know. I can't imagine making a film, a real film, in a place you're at war with. But the other thing that really stood out for me was the theme of the show. Sure, it was a coming-of-age film, but it was set in the world of Buzgashi, which is a horse polo game played with a dead goat instead of a ball. I was curious, so I sat down with the filmmaker Sam French to find out some more.
Well, I first saw Buzgashi when I first got to Afghanistan in 2008. I had arrived fresh off the plane and didn't really know what to expect when I got there. With a bunch of people that I had met in Kabul, we went up to Mazar-e-Sharif up north at Nowruz, which is the New Year over there. Up in Mazar-e-Sharif, they really play Buzgashi. It's huge. So it was a humongous field with mountains in the background, and there were no out of bounds. So it was a bunch of people, thousands of people standing in a big circle, and sometimes the horsemen would just plow right through the crowd.
Well, I think I should interrupt here. I don't think anyone listening probably knows what Buzgashi is, including me. How does it play? What's the game?
So Buzgashi is the national sport of Afghanistan. It's been played for hundreds and thousands of years. It's basically horse polo, but it's played with a dead goat carcass instead of a ball. So if you can imagine 12-foot-tall men on horses riding around in a field trying to grab a dead goat carcass, gallop around a flag, and put it into a circle in the middle of the field.
You know, I can't actually really imagine it. But the more I think about it, I did spend some time looking it up. And it was amazing to see. It looks just intense and brutal. And I think the matches I saw were in the snow and the mud, and people were running into spectators. And all the time there's this dead goat being due to the center. It was kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah, Buzgashi is an incredibly visual game. I mean, if just imagine horse polo with a dead goat carcass. I mean, and there's a 40, 50 to 100 horsemen on a
Did you say 100? You said 100, right?
50 to 100 horsemen. I mean, okay. In Mazar-e-Sharif, where I first saw Buzgashi, there were hundreds of horsemen in this wide, vast plain with dust being kicked up by the horses as they thunderously gallop past the crowd, all tight together, and their breath is, you know, steaming in the mountain cold winter air. And they're rearing up and over each other. And then in the middle of this mess, a guy reaches down and grabs a goat carcass from the ground and struggles and breaks free of the scrum and gallops away around this flag and then back and throws the goat into the circle.
With his hands, right? There's no tools.
With his hands, yeah. So he reaches all the way over, down to the ground, and grabs it with his hands. There's been stories of horses that have been trained to pick it up with their teeth, but that's a legend.
I love it. It's a good legend, though.
When I get in.
What does it mean? I know it's the national sport of Afghanistan, but what does it mean to Afghan culture, this sport?
I was quite shocked when I went to Afghanistan that, you know, they like to fight everything against each other. So I went to a camel fight in Mazar-e Sharif. There's dog fighting. There's cock fighting. It's an incredibly poetic country, but it's an incredibly harsh country as well. And the Afghan people are as hard as the mountains. They have incredible hospitality, and I've been welcomed in warmly to many Afghan houses, and I absolutely love them. But also very hard. So Buzkashi, I think, is a testament to how hard they are. I think at one point, an American cowboy came over to Afghanistan and went to a Buzkashi game and had planned to go and get on a horse and join, and chickened out because it's pretty violent.
You know, it makes me think. It's like the country. I was once described to me Afghanistan as brutal but beautiful, and it seems like the sport is brutal but beautiful as well.
Yes, indeed, it is. Yeah.
You know, we should back up for a second. Could you give us just a brief thumbnail sketch of the film?
Sure. Buzkashi Boys is actually about two young 12-year-old boys living in Kabul. They're both very poor. One is a blacksmith's son and one is a street kid. He's a spandi, which he waves this sweet seed that he burns in a can, and it's supposed to ward off the evil eye. And so he's begging on the street. But they're best friends, Rafi and Ahmad, and they both dream of being Buzkashi riders. Of course, that dream is almost unattainable for young, poor Afghan kids, but they do dream of being Buzkashi riders. And the film is about their life and their friendship, and it's about their one small step into being men.
I'm hearing you talk about filming Buzkashi and talking about these boys. You're an American from Philadelphia. How in the world did you end up making a film, nominated for Academy Award, I might add, a film in Afghanistan, a country in which your country is waging a war in right now?
Yeah, well, life definitely takes interesting turns sometimes. I guess I can give you a brief background of my story. I went to USC Film School, graduate school in Los Angeles, and one of my very close friends and collaborator in film school was this guy, Martin Rowe. He's British, and we did a lot of projects together. And he introduced me to this wonderful woman named Anna, who's also British. And she worked for the British government and was posted to Afghanistan in 2008. So I'm just one of thousands of struggling filmmakers in Los Angeles. And so I decide, why not? Let's just go and see what it's like, because I imagine there might be some stories to tell. So I packed up and went to Afghanistan to be with Anna. And I did. I found a country that you do not see in the news. What I saw on the news before going was just bombings and bullets and the Taliban. And I got there, and it was an incredibly rich country. So I decided to stay and start a documentary film production company to try to tell some of these stories that you don't see on the news. That led into 5 years later, I was still there. Martin actually came and visited me in Afghanistan in 2009. And we had been writing this $100 million science fiction film script at the time together. And he got there and we started traveling around the country. And he was seeing it for the first time. And I was seeing it for the first time again through his eyes. And we said, we have to write a narrative fiction film set here. And that was the genesis of Buzkashi Boys.
Your narrative fiction film is the first Western film to be made entirely in Afghanistan since 1978, since the Soviet invasion. I lived a little bit in Eastern Europe, so I have some sense of this, but logistics, not to mention the danger, must have been a nightmare. What was the logistics like trying to film and during a war in Afghanistan?
The logistics of filming Buzkashi Boys were definitely not easy. We didn't want to just make a film. We wanted to try to help Afghan filmmakers because I had been there and looking around, the TV industry has been supported by the international assistance and it's doing relatively well. It's a lot of journalism and video journalism. But cinema itself hasn't been doing very well because when the Taliban came in, they burned cinemas to the ground. They tried to burn all the film reels they could find. and everyone fled the country. So now there's a group of older filmmakers there who have come back and are making films, like Sadiq Barmak and Atiq Rahimi, and wonderful filmmakers. But there's a whole generation, new generation, there's a generation gap, and the new generation doesn't have access to resources or expertise to make films. So we decided to start an NGO, nonprofit, called the Afghan Film Project, to try to foster Afghanistan's film industry and help any way we can to train Afghan filmmakers. And Biskashi Boys, we wanted to have as our pilot project to actually bring on some trainees and have them have real-world experience in mentor-mentee relationships on the set, on a real production.
You know, I want to ask a question because there's a couple shots, especially in this beautiful old abandoned, bombed-out building. Just a great place to shoot. Where obviously you have a crane. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine you filmed any other way than with a crane and boom mics. And this is a real-looking film with beautiful, sweeping cinematography. Crane seems like a target to me with a bunch of Westerners running. How in the world did you have security? Did you get bombed? I mean, what happened?
We had about 50 people on set. And so, yeah, with a crane and a dolly. So the security profile was pretty big. We took great pains to make sure that we weren't a target by not publishing our schedule and not being in the same location more than a day or two. And we also got the Afghan government support, which allowed us to get local police to be with us on set and act as our security, which is much better than having a big Western security presence because they're part of the community.
You know, I was thinking about the film while I was watching it. Okay, it's kind of basically a coming-of-age film set in a sports setting, which I dig. But I was like, why did you choose that? Was it politically calculated? But there's no war in the film. I mean, there's obviously a lot of poverty in the film, but there's no war. With all the rich subject matter around war, it's interesting that you chose not to do a film about war.
It was a very conscious choice on our part not to do a film about the war. And there's the reason for that is because we want to do a universal story and also show very clearly that there are people who live in Afghanistan, normal people just like you and just like me, who have hopes and dreams. And we didn't want to make it political. We wanted to make it personal. So we chose a coming-of-age story, which is a universal story. It's about two kids who take one step into adulthood. Everyone's gone through that, and they have dreams, you know, and everyone has dreams. So this country, while it's very poor, there are still people who yearn for a better future.
Sam French. He's the director of the film Buzkashi Boys. It was nominated for a 2013 Oscar for Best Short Live-Action Film. Our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, spoke with him. To see the trailer, go to our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on Afghan stories, go to our website, ttbook.org. Follow us on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @ttbook1. Our theme music today was remixed by a listener. Thank you, Steve Shurtleff. Do you want to remix our music? Go to ttbook.org to find out how. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.